All right. All right. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program, a special edition of Charles Moskowitz Live today. We're joined by Leo and Seth, who are co-hosts of the Jew Function. Thanks for joining me, guys. You were both nice enough, and I feel privileged to have joined you on your gangbuster YouTube channel, which is just making huge impact. I think probably even more profoundly than you may realize, in that it's contributing greatly to your stated mission, which is to kind of unpack such things as anti-Semitism and its causes and effects, and generally a look at Judaism overall, who we are, what it is, what we believe in. And you've had people on from all sides of the spectrum, including, you know, for lack of a better term, enemies of our people,
yeah,
like Dr. V. Michael Jones. With due respect to him, he's been a regular guest of mine. But, you know, we have to talk to them in order to find out what makes them tick, what they believe in. And I'm a strong believer in free speech and in the First Amendment. And in that capacity, I think it's important that we, I don't want to use the word expose, but debate all sides, so that our viewers and that people in the culture in general can make up their own minds. And I think that when we do that, the effect is positive, and the effect of suppression is negative always, because it leads to worse ideas that will eventually come out in ways that might not be beneficial. So,
right, it's like medicine. You can't, you know, ignoring the disease doesn't make it go away. So
that's right. So in that spirit, why don't we start by just talking a little bit about what you gentlemen have learned so far on some of these issues? And I know that I'm asking a very broad question here, but we can get into it carefully. In terms of what is this phenomena today that is being described as a rise of anti-Semitism? I'm not sure that there is. I don't know if I really believe that. I think that anti-Semitism waxes and wanes. But let's, for the sake of argument, say that there is an increase in anti-Semitism. What do you attribute that to right now? Why don't we start with you, Leo?
Well, first of all, you know, as you said, I think it's great to be here. So thanks for having us, and it's good to talk about it. And I think it's part of it. We live in a climate where things are coming to light, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. It's like everything is coming out. All the human tendencies, all the manifestations of human desire, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's like we're revealing everything. If humanity used to live, you know, under certain different codes of behavior, of conduct, trying to build certain societies, it's almost like we've came to a place where, all right, we tried everything. We're not sure that, you know, one thing is, you know, increasingly better than another. Everything has its own drawbacks and advantages, and there's this increased focus on the individual, and everybody's kind of bringing up their own thoughts and feelings. Everybody can write a book today. Everybody can start a video channel. Everybody becomes a broadcaster and a consumer of content. So I think that it's like this, you know, moment where all the, excuse the language, all the pus is coming out of the wound, and that's, yeah, what we're seeing.
Everything's coming out of the woodwork, so to speak. Completely.
So yeah. I think we're seeing a lot of that. Now, does it also mean an absolute increase in anti-Semitism? Perhaps. There's definitely an increase in reported crimes and hate crimes. It's just everything is better documented these days, and so you see more of that. The one thing I would argue, and Seth and I talk about it all the time, is that it's a feeling that people have, whether it's it's being expressed as a certain behavior towards Jews or not, depends on the general social climate of the day. Mm-hmm. When it's not acceptable, then, you know, everything is kind of coming down. When it becomes more acceptable, then it has a place to come up. But we think that feelings don't just go away on their own. People feel certain things, and we're just seeing those feelings expressed as behaviors online, offline, you're seeing that. But the feeling is, I believe, is real. There's no question. We're not questioning the feeling. We're not trying to ignore it or try to say it's not true. It's not true. No, it is true. People are feeling it towards Jews. We're asking why.
Now, when you say that there are certain social climates that may be in place at a certain time that seem to increase or decrease this phenomena, I want to kind of dig into that a little bit. Seth, why don't you start with that?
The way that we look after, well, from our background, the way that we're looking at things is from the end. And you look at how Darwin, for example, or evolutionary theory looks at things. You start at the beginning and things develop, and this one defeats this one, and then this one outsmarts that one, and this one goes like this. We're already looking at the end of the whole process.
Okay.
And where it will end up. And from there, going backwards to get to where we are now. And what that does is it gives you a totally different perspective. Somebody this morning showed me the New York Times piece by Ralph Lauder. He wrote
Ron Lauder.
Full page. Biden, you promised to be for Israel and you promised to be against BDS. Okay, another full page in the New York Times, And then, how could you be for BB when he's like this? Or how can you be? Just another, crumb in the trail of history. So in a sense, we're not that impressed by what we see before our eyes. We refer to it because it gives us an emotional response. And at the end of the day, that's what we need in order to move forward. But Charles, was the Holocaust, was the Inquisition, were these not enough, strong enough emotional experiences to get our people to understand something? So what? So another letter to the New York Times or another parade in the street or another something? I mean, how much stronger of an emotional experience do we need to get a reaction that's going to last?
So, well, I guess that the question that I'd have from that, and you talk about kind of the moral arc of history, which was patented by Theodore Parker here in Boston, where I am, back in the 19th century, this idea that we're progressing in an evolutionary social process by which we advance in many ways. I mean, we could look at that materially, spiritually, and that you feel that there's sort of if you think it's an end goal, but I guess that maybe we should bear down a little bit on that. What do you mean by an end goal? I mean, what do you see as opinion? I mean, we can't.
Let's make a really, really easy one. Like a person decides to eat terribly until they get sick and the doctor says you need to be healthy, and then they get to a good diet and end up healthy. On the other hand, you have someone who says, well, I don't like getting up and going to the gym in the morning. Well, I don't like not having the ice cream every night after, but I'm going to make a small amount of discomfort on a regular basis in order to be healthy. They both end up that they have to live a healthy life if they want to be alive. There's two paths to get there. So we see that where we're going to get to is a good place. That's what all the books talk about, right? That's what our sources are trying to lead us to, is something that's good, and not only for Jewish people, a light to the nations for everyone. Nation won't lift sword against nation, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb. I mean, this, I'm getting chills saying it. This is what we want. This is where we're heading. That's the good future. Now, plenty of prophets paint a picture of, merciful mothers eating their own babies. There's ways to get there. And what we're saying is that we want to not go the way of getting sick and almost dying and until we understand what we need to do. Well, there's another way that we can, and it's not that complicated. It's actually kind of simple. It just requires effort on our part because we need to have the emotional impression one way or another. We need to have, you know, Charles, when you go through a hard time in life, that's when we start to understand who we are, the real human nature of people. You know, when you think back of all the difficult times in your life, those are the ones where we grow the most.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, but how can we now, as conscious people, with all of the sages, with Rashbi and Rambam and who we are received our method from is, I mean, the giants of the universe we receive the method from, and right? And but what are we doing every day? Just bickering about shit every day, right? We're not inheriting the incredible things that they, like, imagine you want to pass things on to your child. Now imagine Moses wanted to pass something on, and Rashbi wanted to pass something on, and Rambam wanted to pass. That's what we received. Are we taking what we received and putting in the, and we have to go through it emotionally one way or another, either by the sword or by, you know, anti-Semitism, or by our emotional mature development, conscious emotional development.
Leo?
That was beautiful, Seth.
Yeah.
I think, we're very emotional creatures. That's clearly evident. Even the most rational person out there is first of all an emotional creature that has the capacity to arrange things in certain rational structures, mental structures, present them, maybe write them a certain way, maybe pass them on a certain way. But we're all emotional, we're all feeling things. And in fact, you find that you look back at the really, really intelligent people that have influenced humanity, and more information is coming to light, again, as part of, you know, that's trend of things coming to light, that how they were, you know, very emotional people and influenced by all kinds of ideas that they couldn't explain rationally. And then they had to work overtime to try to make sense of the stuff that they felt and realized, you know, not through rational process, but through a process of discovery, if you will. And so it's very tough because everything we do in life has an emotional story attached to it. So it's hard for us to put things aside and just kind of look at what's before us, look at nature, mm-hmm. look at all the signs that are out there and try to discern, really, just using our basic faculties. You don't have to be a genius to say, well, this goes here and this leads there. And the funny thing is that we're able to do it very well with sort of the lower degrees in nature. You can kind of track the development, the transitions and on the, you know, geological level, crystals. Plants, very good. Animals, we can see bacteria, how it's moving from single-celled organism and competition and mutual destruction and fighting over resources and all that into a more collaborative until they become a super organism. So you mm-hmm. look at this and you could say, well, I wonder if we could do it as humans, move from this individual, you know, me, little bit of this here into some sort of a collaboration. You see it in the human body. You see it in all levels of nature. But it's the right. hardest thing to see it in yourself. So this okay. is kind of where we are. We just had a great conversation. When was that? A couple of days ago with Thane Rosenbaum. He's mm-hmm. a great, very interesting character. And it's like, you see all the signs before you, all that evidence. But yet to actually accept it, it's very tough because humanity as a whole, we're still on the level of a five-year-old, right?
Right.
That's what humanity is. Individually, we have individuals who are giants, as Seth said. But collectively, this is like a somewhere between kindergarten and junior high with, I like this guy, I don't like this guy. Let's do a little,
sure.
you know, scheming behind the back of this guy or this girl, and now we're not going to talk to this guy. You know, that's the level that humanity has been able to get to, and this is me being nice. If you actually peel the layers off of what's happening in the, diplomatically, as we call it. We gave it such a nice name, diplomatically. Just a bunch of kids in the playground, you know. You play with this toy, I'll play with this toy.
Savages.
We're really not better than monkeys. So
I don't know about that, but I think that, we are, you're right. You're right in that. I think mankind is at a very early stage of understanding the nature of the natural world. I mean, I study psychology in college, and one of the things that my professor saying is that it's a very young science, and that we really don't understand what it is that makes the human mind and the human brain, literally, physically, not to mention human emotions, work.
No clue.
The missing ingredient there is, I believe, God, is the supernatural, because, it seems evident to me that that there's a divine element to the universe, because when you wake up in the morning and open your eyes, that doesn't just happen by accident. There's something that, at least in its origins, was a partnership of the supernatural to create the natural world. And that it's something that's beyond our perception as human beings, because we're imperfect beings. But I also hear both of you seem to imply make reference to a potential messianic age, that, we'll reach a point where we will have achieved a spiritual level that would hasten the arrival of a messianic age, however that is, whether that be some guy standing on the top of the Mount of Olives, I have no idea.
This is really important, I think, and Seth will add to that as well. But I think a lot to do. I think a lot of of this life, is just one big misunderstanding. Life is essentially an act of ongoing translation. If you think about it, mm-hmm. genetically, stuff goes from the core of the cell to the outside. It goes through translation. It's not a direct thing. Reality is perceived. It's getting translated in your brain. You don't actually perceive what's happening outside. You get a picture. Is it true?
A very small picture.
Five
holes.
If they're even there, it's like, right. the whole thing is we're constantly dealing with translation and poorly translating what's happening around us. The Bible is another great example of. I just heard Jordan Peterson in a clip saying, if you think about it, the Bible is the first book humanity had, and it influenced all the other books in Western civilization, at least. And you think about it, it's like, oh, it's true. That was the first, like when everybody had a book, it's like, oh, did you get that book? That one book? Oh, yeah, it's the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. Every other book was written based on that. Everything was an interpretation or a commentary or a departure from, it was all relative to that book. That was the book, right? So I think, where am I going with all of this? I think we have a bit of a misunderstanding of what's going on. We're very good at confusing ourselves. Constantly, consciously, unconsciously, you can say nature has kind of set us up regardless. And so a lot of the terminology that we're using, a lot of the ideas that we have, again, they're very emotional. But if you strip them from those emotions, you're left with something very clear. There's an end goal, as Seth said. The end goal is, we're called in Hebrew, Adam, right? Mankind is Adam, from the word domeh, similar to. That's the word that the Kabbalists describe this creature, this advanced monkey, if you will, because he had the potential to reach that degree where it becomes similar to this upper force. It's not.
I thought that the Donma, wasn't that is a secretive sect in Turkey, primarily that were followers of the false messiah Shabtai Zevi?
Listen, I'm not familiar. I mean, I know the story of the Shabtai Zevi, but... again, since everything is an offshoot from the same core, then the answer would be probably, clearly it wasn't the right path. It didn't it reached a dead end. But when you really when you follow the breadcrumbs, the trail of breadcrumbs, you see a story of, look, there's a force that's all loving, giving, a positive force. Okay, don't think of it as God, divine, that might scare some people. A positive force, like plus in electricity, and it wants to connect with this other force, the minus, but you can't connect. Because they're opposites. The one doesn't feel the other. I cannot feel something unless I have something of that thing in me. You need some equivalence of form. That's the whole idea of equivalence of form. If we can develop something about ourselves that would be similar to this positive quality, mm-hmm. bingo, you can get in touch with this upper force and all. And Messiah, everybody says Mashiach, Messianic. Mashiach is from the word limshoch, to pull, like Moses. It's the same, it's a force that can pull you up. How can it pull you up? Like magnets, you need some relationship. You need to have a certain, you know, polarization of the particle, and then it can react to a magnet the same way. Right now, we're on one pole. We're all just negative. We're just give, give, you know, take, take, take. If we can add some giving, some bestowal, some of this, these other qualities that the divine is usually associated with, we can actually start to feel that force pulling us. You don't need a man on a mountain. You don't need anything. It's a feeling that everybody will just naturally feel.
Well, this gets into, in a way, back to what we're talking about here, which is perhaps the roots of anti-Semitism, in that it goes to what is the Jewish mission, the mission of the Jewish people as, you know, to use the phrase, the chosen people, which I think is something that's been grossly misunderstood by not only the non-Jewish world, but also within Judaism by Jews who might take somewhat of a chauvinistic attitude that we do have the right to physically control or transform the world, which of course is the roots of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, and which is, you know, untrue, because the real purpose of the idea of the chosen people is that we're not here to rule anybody. We're not here to rule over other people or even ourselves. It's not a physical or temporal thing. It's more that we are here to know and to serve and fear God. That's the whole idea. That's why in the Torah at Sinai, there is an extra layer of ritual observance that's put in specifically for the children of Israel. And it's not because they're chauvinistically better or anything else. And again, this can be a misinterpretation even among Jews. It's more that we are to be more subservient to God as a way of witnessing the creator of the universe. And by doing so, being a light, you know, raising our own spirituality, that at the same time being a light unto the nations of the world, so that we can help hasten the arrival of a messianic era, which can't be done by the force of arms, which of course is the communist idea. And, you know, the in a sense, the jihadist idea. It's more of a spiritual mission of knowing God, fearing God, walking humbly with God, and exercising compassion and mercy, because we're all imperfect beings. And when you see other people do things that are not good or imperfect or sinful even, you know that we're all capable of that. So we, you know, while we have a civil society which deals with proper punishment, we also exercise compassion, because we're not perfect, never will be perfect, until God decides. That's not something that's in the hands of humans.
If you, there's no shortage of, by the way, Harry Potter might be the biggest bestseller now, but the other one we're talking about is the Bible, and there's no...
Bible's still number one.
Is it? Okay. So this probably also holds another record for the most misinterpreted book of all time, because everybody takes that book and turns it into whatever they want it to mean. So, and then you take a lot of very smart Jewish people, quote unquote Jewish people, and you know, and you have this book. Okay, so a snake talked to a woman, and then a bush talked to a guy, and then an ocean split in half. Okay, that's what we're going to build. You know, okay, gotcha.
I'm okay with all that.
Fine. It's you know, it's a lot to swallow. So, with the same lens of translation, we also look at what is it? What is a Jew? What is Israel? What is chosen? Right. The same way that you're going to look at a snake talking to a woman in a garden. So what does it mean really? How can we understand what's really going on there? How can we understand what's really going on in the story? So how can we understand what Israel really is? How can we understand what the mission of the Jewish people really is? You know, are we talking about some ethnic people or some tribe somewhere who is chosen to be the number one tribe on some rock in some galaxy, you know, in the middle of black space somewhere? You know, is that what we're talking about? You know, these get to be the strongest group, or What we are saying, what we're discovering, is that this group of Jews is made up of a lot of people, a lot of different kind of people from actually all of humanity. You have some small ones, some big ones, some dark ones, some red ones, some yellow ones, some all different colors, all different sizes, all different shapes. You have left ones and right ones. You have militant ones and peaceful ones. It's a very, very unique group. We have to start to really understand, what does it mean to be a Jew? Who is a Jew? And then if it means that among, because Charles, if you took a million people, start with a billion, narrow it down to a million, and you started to ask them all, you know, who cares, you know, about, and you can kind of make a pyramid out of their desires. Not Maslow's pyramid, but the amount out of that million, for example, who really, really cared about working day in and day out for a better world. I'm not talking about the Greenpeacers and stuff. I'm talking about ones who wanted everyone to feel in their hearts love and care, right? Because probably a lot of the other ones are, they're fighting against something. It's not, but you get to the essence of, who wants to make love and goodness for everyone? It starts to be like a very, very small group. Most people just dealing with food and then survival and other things. Until you get to a tiny group. Even within the Jewish people, you can make that same pyramid. There's also a tiny group amongst us who really want to find some way for everyone to be okay. I mean, mostly what's going on in Israel, I think we talked about it a little bit last time, right? I mean, everyone is against each other. Mm-hmm. How many people really want to find a way for everything to be good? What it's like, my God wants you to be subservient to me. My God wants to kill you. My God wants to destroy that faction. My God can't wait till, you know, you get unelected. My God can't. What is that? So when we think about what it means to be a Jew, we think that it's something, it's an inner feeling. Of course, we could talk about all of the complex things around it. We're not talking about citizenship right now. We're not talking about synagogue membership, but we're talking about the essence of what we think the world needs and what's at the root of this thing called anti-Semitism. What's the anti-venom? What's it called?
Antidote, like your book.
The antidote. Yeah, the antidote, you know, which by the way, contains, you know, one of our teachers always talks about that. The, you know, the medical staff thing has a snake around it. You know, it's like the antidote always contains a little bit of venom inside of it. Mm-hmm. So we're also not naive that we're not talking about angels here. We're talking about...
A tough answer, but you know, in a way, you're bringing up something that actually is both the great strength and the weakness of the Jewish people historically and today, which is that we are all so different. And you know, the old saying that we have three Jews, you got three synagogues. You know, it's like we don't.
No, two Jews, three synagogues. One for me, one for you, and one we don't go to.
Oh yes, like thank you. So yeah, I mean, it does kind of describe the situation, and yet there is a basic cohesion there.
The cohesion
at the end of the day. So I guess that the question is, what are those basic, if any, cohesive principles that we generally do accept as identifying Judaism? And also within this is the keys to understanding anti-Semitism. I mean, I talked briefly about the chosenness and how that's been misinterpreted. And that anti-Semites believe this conspiracy, that it's a secret idea to control the world. But even if you take that away, the idea that we would want to be closer to God and to know God and to take on an extra level of moral and ethical principles, which is the purpose of the ritual principles. I mean, they're not just something that exists as window dressing. They're supposed to create and rise in us a more of a moral and ethical sense that is in accord with the rules and the laws and the commandments and the precepts of the Torah. And that results in resentment. People look at you. You know, we don't like to see someone down the street who's holier than us. You know, we think they are. In fact, we're not. But, you know, there's a perception or an understanding. that they are. So there's a certain resentment. But I guess that to bring it back, what are some of these principles that we can accept that are universal to us and to
Leo, maybe you could talk about that, but I'd say before you do to set it up, Charles, there's two pieces to that. On the one hand, anytime you want to, you know, just the nature, not we like it or don't like it, but that when you want to get strong, there always has to be resistance.
Okay.
Right. So that's one piece of it. There's always resistance. And the other piece of it is we need to organize ourselves in a way that we're not rubbing what we're doing in other people's faces, so that they're not, I mean, it's a tough balance between these two things. There has to be resistance in order to grow. And on the other hand, if our unity is pissing everyone off, then it's not really unity. Or if our practice is done in such a way that it's totally disgusting to the rest of humanity, then we have to look at it. You know, maybe we're missing something. So Leo, I pass it to you with that, but I think there's these two pieces in understanding that.
Okay, but I mean, I think that the general body of Jewish thought and of the Jewish
let me give that. I know Leo had something to say. I cut him off.
No, I'm sorry.
You can add. I mean, I know where you're going with this, Charles. There are things that if you ask today on the street, and by the way, we ask a lot of Jews that come on our show. We ask them, how would you define a Jew? How do you explain what is a Jew, or what are Jews to an alien who would come down here and see such a tiny group?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question.
That gets so much attention and yields an unproportionate amount of influence. It's like, who are those people? And the one common thread is that nobody gave us a straight answer. That's the one common common thread. But at the same time, everybody had an answer. You know, everybody felt something they couldn't quite put in words. So they went somewhere comfortable. Some said, well, it's a certain history and a certain tradition. Well, it's a belief in one God. It's you know, behaving a certain way. It's maybe being the moral compass. It's all kinds of things. But if you tell a Jew these things, no one is going to say no. The question is, you know, what's the root of it? Like, what's the unifying factor behind all those things? Because just like the Bible, for whatever reason, right, not even talking about it, you know, is that first book that Western civilization had, and then everything kind of sprung out of that, like it or not. We're all, as I said, commenting, reacting to, against, for. In the same way, we're all springing from one place. And that place has to do with this end goal that Seth talked about at the beginning. And that is a story that Kabbalists explain what it is. You know, people may feel it intuitively. It exists in many other myths because it's touching, has true roots, right, in really the existence of this whole reality. And that has to do with the relationship with some upper force, higher force. Okay, you don't need to believe, you can believe it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change the fact that there is an origin to the whole business, mm-hmm. right? Then there was a falling out with that original, from that original state to the state we're in right now, which everybody agrees is the worst possible state. And then there's some sort of a climbing back up to a return to that, right? To that original state. But now return as my own independent creature. Okay, that mm-hmm. that story, that 1, 2, 3, the, you know, little trajectory. You find it in many cultures. It's like it's everybody's.
We need to name that.
What's that?
We need to name that. It's to refer to that.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, we talk about
1, 2, 3.
Well, we call it the plan of creation. You know, it's what, you know, Kabbalists refer to it as the plan of creation, or the thought of creation, right? Right. Mm-hmm. You have this force that's all good, giving, positive. It wants to give, but it fills everything. It's beyond even space and time, but it just wants to give. So what would a force that wants to give do? Create something that can receive, right? That's like the next, it's a very logical plan. I mean, if you think about it. Okay, I want to give something. Right. It's like, you know, I'm a mother.
No, I have so much to give.
Right.
You mentioned Kabbalah, and you guys seem to be pretty well versed in that. And I don't claim to be. I mean, I know something about it, but my understanding is that it primarily focuses, at least the Zohar, on the very first few passages of the book of Genesis, of the Torah.
No,
the
incorrect.
Creation of the universe.
Incorrect. I'll fix it. But let me just finish that 1, 2, 3 story, because it answers your question. I want to give everybody listening an answer. Mm-hmm. So it creates a creature, something. It's not even a creature yet. It's a quality that can receive, right? So if I can give, I want something to receive. Very simple. Up to here, it's perfect. The whole story could have, you know, could have ended there, and they lived happily ever after. The problem is that thing that could receive, that quality, is not independent, is not conscious, doesn't have any free will. It's like, you know, I made you, now I'm going to fill you, and that's it, right? There's no, where's me in this whole story, right? Where's that really? So Kabbalah explains, and again, other myths talk about it, but of some sort of a process of, right, removal from that original state, that Garden of Eden, if you will, that state, like, okay, I can receive everything, it's all there. You fall from that, you know, so we fall to that state that we have here. We're not going to get through the whole, we don't have time to explain the whole thing, but we end up with our current perception, space, time, our perception of separateness. And now we're trying to
emptiness.
Move back. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, the whole thing. So I'm constantly empty, constantly chasing pleasure. That's who I am. I'm a desire to receive pleasure, so I'm chasing pleasures. And I'm doing it at the expense of everything and everyone because I can, right? Rocks, plants, animals can't.
Yeah, let me chime in for a sec. The light fills this complete vessel, and then the light leaves, and now it left an impression inside this vessel of, or this receiving force of wanting to be filled, but it left it, you know, at the beginning of the physical creation. So it takes a long time for that creation to develop itself, to understand, how do I need to be? Okay, I think I'm going to be fulfilled by eating. Okay, I ate, but I need more. Okay, I'm going to be fulfilled by making a family. Okay, I made a family, but I need to get out of the ocean. Okay, that still didn't do it. And it's not conscious yet, you know. Then it develops the plants, then it develops the animals, then it develops to us. And we're still trying to understand, how can we attain that feeling that was left in us of emptiness from when the light left? And this is all, we also, another part of our story is, we look at all of creation as one organism, as one creature together.
One vessel. The word we use in Kabbalah is vessel, kli, right? A vessel. Mm-hmm. You know, but so
klipot, so right?
Well, klipot is something else.
That's something else.
But the kli is it. So the whole thing. So now you ask, what is a Jew in all of this, right? So in order to bring humanity back to the feeling where it actually feels, senses, is in contact with this upper force, who some are calling God, some are calling, right, the upper force, some are calling the grand unified theory, whatever you want to call that force. But it's a force. It has thought.
We use the euphemism of God. I mean, we don't know the name of the force.
Right, right.
God's just a euphemism, but it's one that's generally accepted.
Right, right. And again, the Jehovah or Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, that denotes the process that we're giving. But really, what it is, it's beyond us. We call it Atzmuto in Hebrew, or his essence, or it, right? This you cannot attain. But you can attain the next best thing, right? So you can attain that. How do you attain it? By, if that force is love, giving, unity, you need to also become similar to that, or aspire to it. That's how you begin to come into equivalence of form with that. So that quality that was broken in the process of coming down to this level of reality, what was broken is our sense of unity, meaning our perception was broken. We're not separate. Kabbalists don't say we're separate. We're still one kli, one thing, one creation, right? But we are living it separately. You'll also find that idea in many other thoughts and belief systems. The question now is, how do we get from this broken state, which many agree is indeed a broken state, removed from God, where, you know, God is dead to us, all of that. How do you get back to contact with this upper force? Upper meaning because it was our origin. It's not because it's in the sky somewhere.
How do you get to it?
Very good question. The simple answer
Tune in
is,
next time.
Okay.
The simple answer is, you make efforts to unite. Just like everything works, you know, we'll give a different example that we give often is, how do you grow up from being a baby? Do you remember what you did to grow up, Charles?
Right.
You play, okay? Mm-hmm. You play the next thing you want to be. Okay, animals play, you know, a small tiger plays how to be a big tiger. That acting, right? Those acts, the playfulness, they're really serious. They determine the direction of the development of that creature. So every creature plays the next role in its development. And then the forces that exist all around you, they work on that effort simply. And the same goes for humans. As a kid, you play, right? You play that you're like speaking, and then suddenly a child speaks. How do you speak suddenly? What changes, right? You make efforts, and then the light or that force, or whatever you call it, the force of development in nature works on it. All these processes in life follow the same process. So we as humans collectively need to start playing nice. We have to start playing as if we want to band against our ego. The ego says, no, this is mine, this is yours. No, we say, okay, I get it. We get it. This is our nature. Let's play above that nature. That's what needs to happen. We can no longer run in different directions. We can no longer get a divorce. We cannot move to the other side of the planet. That's it. It's full. It's done. The plan is, you know, it's been complete. Now you have to actually do the work.
Do you think that God has agency? Final sentence.
Yeah. And Jews were simply the people, representatives of all the nations that lived in Babylon 3,500 years ago, who were, you know, who had that inkling in them. They had a desire towards that. They were a little more refined, call them, not intellectually, just the feeling in the heart. And they followed Abraham, who said, hey, there's a method. He observed nature. You can say he was given that method. It doesn't matter. He had it, right? He saw it. He felt it. He found it. He figured it out. The force of nature helped him. And he collected these people and said, hey, you want to learn how to do this? Said, yes. That was the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Not a genetic thing, not an ethnic thing, none of those things. And they evolved, developed. They hold that method subconsciously inside of us. It's like built into our spiritual DNA, if you will. And now we need to show the rest of humanity how to do it. So it's not a personal thing. You don't want to do it, fine, but it needs to be done. It has nothing to do with your feeling about it. It simply has to be done. A certain group of people by starting to act.
If we look at the Jewish covenant, if you will, I mean, isn't it that, you know, by knowing and fearing God and by following the moral and ethical precepts of the Torah, we welcome the agency of God into the world, and that we, you know, that we and that the practical side of that is prayer, and ethics, and
the answer is either no or yes, but you're misinterpreting it.
Okay.
You hit the nail on the head. Prayer is the end result of a lot of acting. Okay, when you really want something and you try, there's a famous parable, Kabbalists use it, you know, there's a big difference between someone who like, I wish I got this new car, right? Versus someone who is sentenced to death, is sitting on death row waiting for that thing. Who do you think prays harder? The death row guy probably, right?
Right.
Meaning prayer is not a, say these magic words and stuff will come from the sky. No.
It's just knowing and fearing God, whatever that means.
No. So there is a meaning. It's work in the heart. Prayer is work in the heart, meaning the heart has to be arranged a certain way for that request to come. And it will come with words, without words. It doesn't matter. It's a real thing which comes from the heart. The only problem is it can only be aimed at greater unity in the system. No other prayer is being answered ever. The fact that you may ask for something and it comes is not proof of that. It's simply, it's maybe part of the big scheme, right? The whole system is moving one way, and you happen to ask for something and it serves that system. But that's not what the prayer is about. God didn't make the world in such a way that, let me screw you up so you can come, you can get a bad car so you can ask for a better car. Or
no, that's not, prayer isn't praying for Mercedes Benz.
Right.
Please, God, let me score this touchdown, you know.
Exactly. Thank God for helping us, you know. Praise the Lord that we won this game. No. Prayer is only to bring greater unity into the system. That's what you can pray for, should pray for. You don't know how to pray for it. But Jews have a natural inclination towards that because we were given that method 3,500 years ago. And we sort of carried, and here's the nice part. We talk about, if you really kind of strip things down and take away all the external things and the mitzvahs that we don't know what they mean and all that, those are all internal things that we misinterpret. But they were good. They kept us together in the diaspora. But if you take that away, what you're left with is a lot of togetherness and warmness and Shabbat dinner, as you said, you told us in our episode, and mutual help and community and a sense of, I don't feel comfortable, you know, killing these people, right? Is there any other way? No, okay, well, okay. You know what? It's this kind of feeling of like we're somehow all belong together. Jews have
that. But is it also prayer, you know, in a way, an internal understanding of what does God want for me in this world as a person? What is my mission, if any, to in terms of serving God? What is the direction of my life? And you know, when you pray, however that comes about, and that's not necessarily in the formal prayer of a minyan or whatever. Although the whole minyan idea is incredible.
I mean, where does it come from? It's the same thing.
Well,
it's
every single day together. That the sun comes up from the day that God created the universe until today, there has been a minyan of well, I suppose it didn't happen with Adam, but there's a minyan of 10 Jewish circumcised bar mitzvahed men, and now with Reform and Conservative Judaism, women too, that get together and are able to have certain levels of prayer. It's a perfect example of a collective experience.
True.
But it has to be done by individuals who want to engage in the prayer so they can know and fear God. And as individuals. So it's both individual and collective at the same time.
You have.
And I guess it gets me to ask you, what do you think that God has agency in the world? And if so, how does that manifest?
Seth?
I'm not sure what that
is. A good tough question.
Shamati one, it doesn't matter. Shamati one answers that question.
What does it mean that God has agency?
Well, I mean, in events in our life and events in politics and events in culture, is God part of that? I mean, this is, you know, if you look at the Torah, for example, when the Jewish people, the children of Israel, the Israelites, when they got closer to God, then they were blessed and they did better and they had more strength. And when they fell away from God and when they got involved with temptation and sin and idol worship, then they'd be punished and there'd be bad stuff happening. And then there was a cycle back and forth that runs like a thread throughout pretty much the entire Torah.
Yeah. So we'll lift the curtain here. We can't really comprehend it, in our minds yet, but we will. You know what, Charles, have you ever, you know, when there's an incredible event that goes, if you put on a big event sometimes, right, and you dedicated, I don't know, hundreds of hours to a huge event, and you didn't sleep, and you just pushed yourself to the end, and everyone comes to the event, and it happens, and at the end, they say, and, you know, and we really want to bring up Charles Moskowitz, who just dedicated his whole life to make this whole thing happen. And what does Charles do when he gets up there? He goes, you know what? If it wasn't for my wife, I could have never done this. And, you know, it really wasn't me. It was all these other people who worked along my side. You know this experience I'm talking about?
Sure.
Okay. So there's something in Psalms that says, I think, Imashem lo yivne bayit, like if he doesn't build it. So let's just lift the curtain. What we're going to discover, we're not doing anything at all. Only the Creator is doing absolutely everything. He has complete agency over everything, and all that's happening is is that there's a veil called world from the word ha'alem, like a concealment. There's just different levels of concealment between us and what he's actually doing, and why it comes back again to emotion. Why does it come back again to emotion? Because Charles, if all of a sudden your biggest hero in Jewish history was sitting next to you, right? Who's your biggest history and your biggest hero in all Jewish history? Moses. I don't know. Pick anyone. Moses. Moses knocks on the door. He's like, Charles, hey, it's Moses.
A couple of others, but yeah.
Okay. Pick your favorite one.
Yeah.
There are some key people in Jewish history that have changed.
Name one. It's a cute anecdote, but
Ezra the scribe.
Okay, Ezra the scribe comes and he knocks on the door and says, Charles, it's me, Ezra. Listen, I got a chance to come back. And I was just wondering, I know you're busy today, but you have time for lunch? Of course I have time for lunch. And then at the end of the day, after 8 hours of sitting together, he's like, Charles, I know you're tired. He's like, no, I'm not tired. you know, Charles, I know you need to go to bed. No, no, I'm not. So what happens is when somebody so great is with you, your self-determination is totally annulled. You just do whatever, right? If Ezra the scribe was sitting with you, you can tell him, well, Ezra, you know, I've got an email I have to send out, or Ezra, I'm working on my manuscript. No, whatever Ezra wants to do, I'm game. Ezra, you want to walk? Ezra, you want a coffee? Ezra, you want to stay up all night? Because he's so great in your eyes. Now from Ezra, imagine to this force called the creator or God or whatever it is. If it was revealed the greatness of God, we would have no self-determination at all. Forget Ezra the scribe. We would have no self-determination. We'd be totally annulled before something so great. So what happens is everything is concealed, 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 until we think, like a child in the sandbox thinks he's got control of what's going on in his life, but his parent is above watching. And all of it, as Leo was saying before, is just for us to build emotional perceptions of this, to build an emotional perception. Because if there was no concealment at all, we'd be back to that first state where we're one and everything is one, but we have no sense of self at all. Mm-hmm. So the short answer
independence. Is... We're like animals, like cockroaches, right?
I mean, there's no the short answer is God has complete agency over absolutely everything. And what will actually happen, well, let's just say that's the answer. Yeah, the answer is yes. Well,
I'll add another layer to the answer. So that's the first part that Seth said, you know, we call it there's nothing besides him, right? That's mm-hmm. the line. That is true. The other thing is, and he is good, that's good. However, we're not feeling the goodness, right? Because we're opposite. We're in opposition of form. So mm-hmm. you don't feel that goodness at all. You only feel constant pressure that should eventually orientate us towards, wait, where's all that stuff coming from? Who's responsible for it? Who's to blame? Who can I, right? So the creator, you know, he tells, you know, in the book of Job, he says, I only created one thing, the evil inclination. He says, I've created the evil inclination. I didn't create anything good. What are you coming to me for? I created the evil inclination. You correct it, turn it into a good inclination, then you'll be able to feel me and we can have a connection. So as I said, God is doing everything to, you know, sabotage our best efforts as long as they're not aimed at uniting people. Everything, every technology, you'll see, every technology can be used again, can and will be used against you. Everything, nuclear weapons, AI, you name it. It could be the best thing. It could be the, you know, remedy for whatever, cancer. The pharmaceutical companies will use it against you. It doesn't matter. Right. Until we correct the way we relate to each other, everything is going to look like shit and smell like shit, even though you're in a field of daisies and everything is great.
Right. And also the missing factor as well is that when God created men and women, and the Torah does say men and women, it doesn't just say men, in his image, which is means that we're not gods and we never will be gods. We can't know all. We, you know, our forefathers and mother, Adam and Eve, violated the order of the universe by participating in the forbidden fruit and trying to be God, to be like God. They believed the...
Hold on, Leo's trying to open up 1,000 more things. I could see it in your eyes.
Yeah, no, we need another episode. I mean,
we're getting into a whole different deal here. And
yeah, if you do, kind of an episode toward the end of the show.
So we'll have to do another. We'll have to do it again because we're just starting to peel the layer of the onion here. But
your eyes look so hungry.
Can we add one thing to the listeners just so they can, until next time, just because you brought up men and women several times. And it's also, I want to, you know, just make sure that, you know, another big misunderstanding, right? So men and women in the you know, if we say this and correct that thing in humanity, that's already a big thing. In the Bible, mm-hmm. which is just another one of the holy books, holy meaning that speak about how to reach this, right, this change that we're after, it simply describes inner states in a person. It's not a history book. It's not a book of miracles. Right. It's not a book of I saw God and I wrote a little, you know, story about my hallucination. It's not that. It's a story, or it's a process, right, of transformation, starting from the beginning of the desire and then until the corrected desire. It starts with Bereshit, ends with Israel. Right, that's the main books. There's other things, and you alluded to
the Zohar. Five books is,
we didn't get to the Zohar, but we'll talk about it. But the point is, it speaks about the desire. Now, just so it's very, very clear to everybody listening, in the Bible, when they say a woman is a desire to receive, okay, it's a symbol of reception, like a vessel, like a woman has a uterus, right? Can have
right. That's right.
That's what the feminine is about. And the masculine gevel, from the word lehitgaber, to overcome, is when you put a screen on top, called in Kabbalah a screen. It's a way to add the correct intention to that desire. So I have a desire to eat without a screen. If it's just it's just a woman, as we call it, just a female, it's just uncontrolled for yourself. You add a man to it, man and a woman together. Now you can eat in order to give contentment to the.
But these both these qualities are inside the same person, either in a man or in a woman. We're not talking about men and women.
Although it's obviously that men and women are very different, and that
they are. There is a point where the difference between, at first everything was kind of united. At some point there was a separation. There's a Kabbalist talk about that mechanism. Not going to get into it, but at some point there was this duality emerged, and now in this world everything is presented as two forces, two opposite forces, plus and minus, men and women, all of that. But make no mistakes, everything contains everything, and a woman can do this work, and men can do this work. You have feminine qualities in you and masculine.
Well,
and
the thing by saying that God created men and women in His image, it's sort of the principle that men and women are equal, and that all men. Men, by I don't mean male, I mean men, are created equal, which of course was codified in the American Declaration of Independence. But the difference was set up in such a way that men and women could come together to reenact the act of creation through the sexual union, and thus you have the family. Anyway, there's too much to get into. We're starting to just open the lens up here a bit. But listen, guys, let my listeners and viewers know where they can watch your excellent program on YouTube, or any other information you'd like to share.
It's all The Jew Function. It's basically at The Jew Function. It's our handle. It's on Twitter, on Instagram, on YouTube, the website, thejewfunction.com. It's all The Jew Function. You have short clips that we're making. You have the full-length programs, talks that you mentioned earlier. There's also a bit of a learning experience about the network science and hubs and nodes and Jews' role in that, or explained through that lens on the website. But it's The Jew Function. So if you follow,
and aren't you also offering some kind of an educational program too?
So that online thing is a design, like a learning experience that you can do. If someone is interested in also the deeper stuff, if you want to study Kabbalah, ask us. We'll let you know where we're studying. But you don't have to study Kabbalah. You just need to follow that point inside of you that says, hey, maybe have a, as you said, I have a special role in humanity. You do have a special role in humanity. If you're feeling it, probably have it.
And also, my understanding of the study of esoteric Judaism, of Kabbalah, it has to be approached with great care. I think traditionally, it was only allowed to men over 40 years old who had reputations that were good and who also, in a way, in reflection of the Sanhedrin, they had to have a regular job, they had to have a family, they had to be in the world, but at the same time, they had to qualify with a level of learning and a level of ethics and spirituality to get into this very important subject, because if it's in the wrong hands, it could be a very dangerous study, and it could be one that could open the portal to hell. Anyway, so...
tune in next time.
We'll do it again soon. I really appreciate it. You both, I admire your work. You're trying to bring people together. You're trying to delve into important questions here that I think release important thinking and all for the good. So I want to thank you both, Seth and Leo, for joining me today.
By the way, Seth has a great book also. You can get Seth.
Where can we get your book?
Which book?
Jew. Are you an author?
Yes, I am. If you go to sethbrightman.com, you'll see the book there. The one Leo's talking to is referencing is about our approach to anti-Semitism, the antidote to anti-Semitism. So it's sethbrightman.com, and you find the that book there.
Is that available on Amazon, or can we get people get that?
Not on Amazon right now, but maybe you'll help me figure out how to do that.
Okay. Excellent. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. And
thank you.
God bless you. Have a good Pesach.
You too. You too, man. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.